This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And once again, we find ourselves gathered together, dearly beloved, for our weekly Q&A with Layla. Layla is our nutritionist in residence. If you're unfamiliar with this format, every week we answer listener questions. You can send questions via email to radioprogram@AOL.com. And FYI, Layla is a registered dietitian, as well as possessor of a master's degree in the field of nutrition. And she's certified to practice nutrition in the state of New York. So, how are you doing, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman, how are you?
Good, good. Well, we're still, the weather's trying to decide whether it's winter or spring, but there's some encouraging signs. Some of the tulips are popping through the ice and the snow.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we've had daylight savings time.
Yes.
And apropos of that, I think we have a question on that
we
subject.
We do.
So why don't we launch into that question?
Right, right. This comes from Carol. Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. I love you guys and all the great content that you provide for us natural health seekers. But as we approach Daylight Savings Time weekend, which kind of passed a week ago, as you know, we've got a little backlog on
these
questions.
There's a little latency in these questions.
Yeah. I know you're probably going to once again call for its abolishment, and I wanted to make
I'm curious as to why they would characterize us as calling for its abolition.
Yeah. Well, you've talked about circadian rhythms and how they adversely impact circadian
And I think we've done some stories in the past about how there are more accidents. There's actually a study out that suggests that the emergency rooms see about 24% increased heart attacks on that morning. Monday mornings being a problem, generally, Monday mornings are that kind of whole compression.
People are sick on Monday morning more than any day of the week.
Yeah, and it's also that sort of stress. And you know how it is on Mondays. I used to have a rule of thumb is don't try to do too much on Mondays. And you over the weekend, you think a lot about all the things you're going to accomplish. You accomplish a couple of things on Monday, that's great. You got through the day and then Tuesday, and then you got the rest of the week.
Good rule of thumb.
People fling themselves into Monday, and then they're also a little sleep deprived from the weekend, maybe a little too much indulgence, a little too much alcohol.
Yeah.
And so Mondays are murder in general. And, and this, we also, when we rotated through the emergency room, we also dreaded being in the emergency room on holidays and on Mondays because we knew that it was, you know, the MIs were going to come in, the cardiac cases were going to come in, you know, the commuters and the, you know, the people who just didn't make it through Monday morning.
So Carol is 66, and she wants to make the case for the physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual health benefits of daylight savings time.
Right.
A time of year she has loved since she was a kid.
Right.
After a long, dark winter, that first evening of added daylight fills my heart and soul with thoughts that spring will soon be here. Carol, you know what? I have to agree with you. Because after that weekend and daylight savings time, I kept thinking to myself, wow, it's not going to be dusk now until after 7. And I, too, was excited.
Well, you know, it depends a little on your perspective. I think the vast majority of people are cheered by it.
Yeah.
And that's because most of us, if anything, we have seasonal affective disorder. We have mood-related issues related to light deprivation.
Yeah.
And so, interestingly, there are people who have reverse SAD. They actually get depressed when it becomes more summery. They prefer, they're wired that way for some reason. And it doesn't sound, it's counterintuitive, but they actually dread the onset of spring and the time of light. They're not vampires.
Yeah. You know? Okay.
But so, I'm not,
I don't know where she pegged us as being inalterably opposed to daylight savings time. Mm. What we merely want to point out is that it is a bit of a physiologic stressor.
It's a little bit of a jet lag.
Yeah, it's clear. I mean, it's like flying from Chicago to New York or something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have to say that I was pretty, you know, I went into it with denial and fortitude.
Uh-huh.
And I have to say that I had a really lousy Monday.
Huh.
It somehow really knocked the starch out of me. Today, as we record this, it's a day after.
That's right.
I feel fine today, but I just did not have a good adjustment to this.
Hmm.
And it's interesting because you think, well, the change occurs on a Saturday night.
Yes.
And you'd think that it would mess up your Sunday. Well, what I did notice is that Sunday, everything was hurried up. It was like, hurry up, it's late.
It's an hour
it's
later.
Late. It's late.
It's an hour later.
It's like, oh my goodness. It's like, yeah, it's late, but I don't feel tired. You know, it's like, go to bed early to get yourself on schedule.
Exactly.
And then Monday, I made myself get up earlier, because the clock said 6:30 and it was 5:30. So I made myself get up at 5:30. And I think that degree of a little bit of sleep deprivation threw me off kilter.
Mm.
What does happen though is for early risers, it's a bit of a problem because just as it's getting lighter in the morning, we've set the clock ahead and therefore it's darker in the morning.
I'm waking up in the dark again.
which is a bummer.
Yeah, it's a total bummer.
Yeah.
I get up early enough that I have to wait in the dead of winter an hour and a half before I see the pink hovering over the buildings.
Right.
It's like the lights are on.
Do you have an SAD light? Do you have a CCD?
No. I don't have
an SAD light. No. I don't know. It just somehow cheers me up a little bit.
Yeah. Oh, that's good.
I don't formally have seasonal affective disorder.
So, I don't either.
It is a bit of a physiologic stress.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people who are all for the abolition of this, but I think that they're Grinches because we do want more daylight time for kids to go out and play.
Sure.
And, you know, from the safety standpoint, the problem, though, is that kids who have, like, extracurricular programs before school, sometimes they get up very, very early.
Yeah.
And they have to get up again in the dark, just as it was getting lighter.
Yes,
so there is some safety issues regarding, you know, them crossing streets and commuting to school, waiting for the bus in the dark, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So
or just commuting in the dark.
Yeah.
There is that. It's interesting what you said, that there are some people who have the reverse, that
they have
SAD in the warmer weather. I would think those people are more maybe homebodies, like being home, curled up, all of that, as opposed to being out and about.
We know someone in common, and you don't mention her name, but she used to work in the office, and she absolutely abhors this time of year.
Oh, yes,
This is the kind of person who looks at the spring and summer fashions in the windows at Saks, and their heart sinks because they like being wrapped up in fur in the winter and hunkered down by the fireplace.
Yeah. Oh, it reminds me actually of that sitcom that was a spinoff from the Mary Tyler Moore Show, Rhoda. And one of the opening things she says is, "I moved to Minneapolis because I thought I'd keep better in the cold."
Okay.
So.
Hey,
that just came to mind.
There are advantages to cold.
Yeah.
And, you know, among the advantages to cold are fat burning.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, there was recently an article. This is another segue, but I think it's of interest. American Journal of Clinical Nutrition had an article about one of our supplements. It's called Capsiate.
Mm.
And Capsiate is a weight loss supplement. It's made by Ajinomoto. You can find it on FullScript. And it works a little bit. It might give you, I don't know, a 2-5% metabolic advantage, which is something. It's not nothing.
Yeah.
But it's not a spectacular, magically melt the pounds off while you know, eat lousy and, you know, sit back in the lazy boy.
Right.
But it was compared to, in terms of generating brown fat, which is the fat burning, it's the good fat.
Mm-hmm. The metabolic fat.
Metabolic fat that actually helps you increase your thermogenesis, your fat burning. And the new finding is fairly recent, in the last 5 or 10 years, is that humans have this, not just in babyhood, but it persists in adulthood.
Mm.
And to the extent that you maintain brown fat, it's more likely you can stay lean. So how can you induce brown fat? Well, you can take Capsiate, and it does help a little bit. But the best way to induce brown fat is to get cold.
Get cold.
Get cold.
And let me give you an example of that. It means having your house thermostat at 60 degrees and wearing a t-shirt and a pair of shorts. Mm-hmm. Not putting on a cardigan or a sweater, but just literally walking around the house like that.
On the threshold of a shiver.
Yeah.
Threshold. Because actually, the shiver is a signature that your brown fat is going to be engaged.
Yeah.
Now
we're burning calories.
Meat locker.
Meat locker, right. Computer room, 55 degrees, maybe 58 degrees. Yeah, yeah.
If you can see your breath, it's too cold.
Right, right, yeah.
So, an alternative way of doing that is to, in the summer, pretty early in the year, I'm jumping in the Atlantic, and I get a cold immersion. Sometimes I come out, my teeth are chattering a little bit, but... You know, and walking to work, walking to work in the cold. I'm cold, it's cold. It's a little bit uncomfortable. Mm. But hey, it's on the principle that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
That's it.
It actually gives a bit of a jolt to the metabolism. We've written a newsletter article on this. Mm-hmm. We didn't rerun it this winter because people have seen it, but it's in our archives.
Another way that cold jolts the metabolism, this was a German study, and I think it was over a year ago, that they said that if you drink 16 ounces of cold, cold water in the morning, it kickstarts the metabolism a little bit. Mm. So try that along with your Capsiate. Mm. And then take, hold your coat while you're walking to work, even though...
But don't drink an ice-cold Coke.
No, don't drink an ice-cold Coke.
And in the self-same American Journal of... We're really free associating now. In the self-same journal of the American Clinical Journal of Clinical Nutrition, they did an article, very interesting article, but did they have to do a study to prove this? What they discovered is that drinking a sugary beverage that is at ice-cold temperature lights up the brain more than drinking a lukewarm sugary beverage. So hence the appeal of that frosty bottle of Coke.
Yes.
It's got to be cold.
It's got to be very cold.
Yeah. And it actually does more for your brain when it's cold. It doesn't necessarily put more calories on.
Huh. Yeah.
But it does. It certainly hits the spot.
And they had to do a study on that?
They had to do a study on that.
Keep that grant money coming.
Exactly. Mm. I think sponsored by, PepsiCo
Coca-Cola?
Or Coca-Cola International.
Oh, my gosh, Carol.
So here's another.
Yeah.
I guess the take-home message is if you want to reduce your sweet cravings, make sure you drink your soda lukewarm.
Huh.
You won't enjoy it as much.
No.
And you'll just say, ugh.
Yeah. It's like drinking tepid water.
Yeah,
it's not the same when you're thirsty.
Cloyingly sweet.
You want some, exactly.
Won't hit the spot as much.
Right. Ah, well. Okay, on to the next one. This comes from Dan. Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. I know when you're prescribed antibiotics that it disrupts the microbiome. Does taking probiotics rectify the balance in the microbiome, or is there a permanent change in its composition? Also, are there more effective probiotics, and if so, what are they?
Super good question. And this is actually the subject of research. First of all, it's been demonstrated that if you take an antibiotic, even short term, it will disrupt your microbiome, not just transiently, but long term.
Mm.
And, can really create a severe imbalance. So what actually rescues that is the fact that no antibiotic kills off everything.
Yeah.
And there's always residual bacteria that can come back. And they reestablish according to a template that we all individually have a template that kind of governs our bacteria.
Yeah.
So that's sometimes why
microbiome mapping.
Yeah, it's sort of we generate the microbiome that we're genetically endowed to have. Mm-hmm. So some of that repletion comes from the appendix, actually. So people say, why?
So the appendix is there for a reason.
For a reason. It's sort of like, why is it there? It's what's called a vestigial organ. In other words, it was once an important organ. Just like some humans have a little extension of their spinal cord, like a little vestigial tail.
Mm.
It's not like, oh, wow.
The coccyx.
The coccyx, the throwback.
Coccyx.
Why is it there? The appendix, it's actually called the vermiform appendix, which means worm-shaped.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a place that's kind of a blind alley in your intestine where bacteria are stored so that when you have food poisoning or when you have some kind of bacterial illness, you still have a repository of good bacteria that can kind of repopulate your intestinal tract.
Wow!
And that's also why so many people develop appendicitis, because it's a trap for bacteria, and if you have bad bacteria, then they infect the appendix, and the appendix becomes inflamed.
So we have a depot.
Yes.
In effect for our
yep.
for our microbiota.
Yeah, for our
storage.
Which was one of the reasons to argue for a high threshold on removing the appendix. You know, some studies have actually suggested that some people can get away with not having their appendix removed and taking antibiotics for an inflamed appendix.
Hmm.
So the point is, do probiotics fix that? Well, probiotics, if you take a broad-spectrum antibiotic, you may be killing hundreds, if not thousands, of species of bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
Then you take a probiotic, which at most may have a dozen different bacteria within it.
Yeah.
So it's not going to be a total repletion.
Mm-hmm.
And, the only way to get a total repletion might be to get a fecal transfer, which would be
right.
overkill after taking antibiotics for the most part,
mm-hmm.
Unless you develop a C. difficile infection, which is a consequence of taking antibiotics.
Right. These probiotic formulations are coming up with even more billions and billions and billions of colony-forming units, CFUs.
It's not so much quantity, it's quality.
It's quality.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So are there more effective probiotics?
And again, okay. What else? Prebiotics are important.
Yes.
And I just saw a study that I'll talk about on the weekend show, which suggests that the key to the microbiome and its benefits is fiber, the right kinds of fiber.
Mm-hmm. That feed. Those are the they're all prebiotics. All the prebiotic foods are
Chinese,
fibrous.
It was a Chinese study.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So there's a variety of probiotics we like a Dr. O'Hara's Essential Formula.
Mm-hmm.
We like orthobiotic products.
RegActive, which generates glutathione.
Mm-hmm.
And
the different.
Actually, I want to reiterate that one of the best strategies, if you have to take antibiotics, is to take something that the antibiotics won't kill, which is Saccharomyces.
Ah.
Because Saccharomyces has an antifungal effect. It itself is mm-hmm. a fungus. But
it's a good yeast.
It's a good yeast that suppresses the growth of Candida.
Yeah.
And it will not be damaged by the antibiotic mm-hmm. because to get rid of it, you'd require an antifungal.
Mm. And those who wind up with C. diff that's not really helped much may be helped by Saccharomyces.
Yeah. And that's why on hospital formularies, you're seeing more and more that they're offering Saccharomyces or Florastor mm-hmm. to patients who receive a lot of antibiotics.
Yeah.
It's more, first they give you yogurt. Okay, what the quality of the yogurt is, who knows?
Yeah.
But, it may have some live organisms.
Mm-hmm.
But more progressive hospitals now have Saccharomyces on formulary for people who are at risk for C. difficile.
Yeah. All right. Dan, thank you very much for your question. All right. Let's see here. Oh, this is great. This is from Stephen. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, your ability to make complex issues understandable to your lay listeners is extraordinary. Why, thank you. If I listen to your podcast longer...
It speaks to the true definition of doctor, which doesn't mean healer, it means teacher.
It means teacher.
Teacher.
Yeah. If I listen to your podcast much longer, I might rush out and apply to medical school. Keep up the great educational and not coincidentally entertaining work. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Highest accolade.
It is. Thank you. Several times recently, you've discussed the protein paradox. Among the dangers of too much protein intake is elevated IGF-1.
Yep.
Insulin-like growth factor 1, which may be cancer promoting. But too little protein is also dangerous, particularly in older people who need protein
yes.
for sarcopenia. So the question becomes, how can each individual determine how much protein to eat?
Okay.
Is it possible that IGF-1 levels, assuming they are readily measurable, there is a blood test, right?
There is a blood test for IGF-1, yes.
Represents a mean of finding out, just as a blood test might for vitamin D,
mm-hmm.
on how much to take?
Yeah, that's really a good question. And, this guy should apply to medical school because he's thinking like a doctor,
mm-hmm.
Let's say you get a patient who is emaciated, and losing muscle. It might be warranted to do an IGF-1 test to see if they have adequate production of IGF-1. Which is not entirely dependent on just protein. Protein per se won't make your IGF-1 go up, but...
The thing about IGF-1 is too much is bad, but not enough is also bad. Right. It's got to be Goldilocks.
IGF-1 is a potential driver of cancer.
Yeah.
And it's also raised, also by carbohydrates.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
Insulin influences IGF-1 because, after all, it's insulin-like growth factor.
Right.
And,
but protein does raise IGF-1, but kind of in a good way, not too much.
So of interest, and again, I think it's American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. There was a study on men, and it just came out, I just noticed it today, which suggested that giving men more protein does not help them build more muscle. Oh, and we're talking about elderly men, whether they consider elderly over 65 or over something.
Hmm.
However, it seems to be a little different in women, is that women, I mean, this is this whole debate as to whether when you get older, you need more protein.
Yeah.
Now, in the past, they've said, you know, eat less protein, protect your kidneys, because some people develop kidney problems. You don't want to overburden the kidneys because they're weaker when you're older anyway. So you don't want to create too many nitrogenous waste products, which have to be passed through the kidneys. You burden the kidneys with the task of elimination. And you might raise your BUN, and that's a marker of inefficient elimination by the kidney. In effect, uremia, toxicity. So so the thought was, limit your protein. Well, now they think that older people, because of sarcopenia, need more for repair.
And osteopenia, osteoporosis.
The bones are living tissue. They're protein, not just mineral deposits. So they did the study in men, and I got to look at the study in more depth. But the study did not come up positive for boosting or supplementing protein in older men, even men receiving testosterone. So you'd think that'd be a great 1-2 combination, is that, and testosterone will build muscle, but adding protein to the testosterone did not augment the benefits of the testosterone in terms of preserving muscle mass or building muscle mass, even with resistance exercise.
Wow.
However, in women, it seems that more protein might be warranted, perhaps because women are a little more prone to frailty and sarcopenia. And also there's this issue of leucine.
Yes.
Which is a branch chain amino acid. There's the three are, go back to biochemistry.
Valine, isoleucine, and...
Leucine.
And leucine,
right. So those are the three what are called branch chain amino acids. Now, if you eat just meat, you'll get mostly those amino acids. The meat, in the sense, is a little bit of an unbalanced amino acid blend. Eggs probably represent a more... balanced blend of amino acids.
Perfect protein.
And organ meat, for some reason, also has a more balanced blend. But muscle meat is maybe to a higher degree those branched chain amino acids.
Yeah.
But therefore, they would be the building blocks for muscle to reverse sarcopenia.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they discovered in women, part of the problem with women who are older is they just don't, they have an aversion to too much protein. They just find that it makes them feel full. So the experiment was, let's give women a modest protein supplement, 15 grams of protein, which is not very much.
Right.
Because what is the woman's requirement for protein in a day? What, 40, 60?
Yeah, at least, I would say at least a good 60.
So they gave women a 15 grams, and they compared to giving just a regular, I guess it's, you know, not branched chain amino acids, but it was a mixed amino acid formula. Versus the 15 grams plus leucine, and they found additional benefits from leucine in terms of staving off muscle wasting and sarcopenia.
Yeah.
So it may be that there's a sex difference in terms of protein efficacy for older individuals.
Sure. Well, you know, they're even saying in the science, in the literature that we have to treat men differently from women. Do you remember the 60 Minutes episode about Ambien? That all the research was done on men,
yes.
And lo and behold, that the dosage of Ambien should be different for women, maybe half as much or some other number. So, yeah, it could be our pesky hormones or who knows what.
And often when they do those studies, they do it in healthy young individuals.
Yes.
You know, so then the very people who take these things are often, they're sicker, they're older, and they don't do as well. So one final observation is, IGF-1 is often a marker for, do you need to get growth hormone? And certain places are rejuvenation centers and longevity centers, and part of their repertoire is to give people hormones, including growth hormone. and growth hormone can build muscle.
Sure.
It can make you look more awesome. It can give you a six pack. And it enlarges your organs. So if you have, organ failure, it helps with repair. So it's been suggested in certain wasting diseases that you give growth hormone. Hmm. But the problem with growth hormone is that the more you have, the more cells replicate rapidly.
Yeah.
And that brings up the issue of cancer.
Yes, where they replicate, grow rapidly, transform, immortalize.
And I've known a couple of patients, I won't mention their names. They're actually sort of celebrity patients. Their names would be recognized, who are big fans of growth hormone.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them died of cancer. Now, cancer is pretty common, but it didn't help.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. So there is an IGF-1 blood test. And yes, that could determine if somebody's IGF-1 is too high, we would look foremost at, hey, too many carbs here. You've got too much IGF-1. That would be more of a marker of too many carbohydrates or hyperinsulinemia.
If you want a detailed discussion on this, then you can read the book, The Longevity Diet, by a recent guest who was really an excellent guest. And he's a really first-class longevity researcher at USC. It's the Longevity Research Institute at USC.
Mm-hmm.
He's Dr. Walter Longo.
Mm-hmm.
And Walter spelled with a V.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Walter Longo.
Longo.
And the Longevity Diet, it's a real complete discussion of how he thinks people should eat, and in particular, how people should eat if they have cancer.
Yeah.
And his view is that in contrast to paleo diets or Atkins diets or, some people's version of a ketogenic diet with a lot of protein, that people should limit their protein.
Yeah.
And in fact, he has products called ProLawn. It's a product line. And it's suggested that people go on a FMD, fasting mimicking diet. Now,
yes.
What the foods are designed to do is they're designed to have mouth appeal and satiety without delivering a lot of protein and without delivering a lot of calories.
Yes.
So that you can do it
because it is it's a lower calorie diet.
Yeah, it's pricey. It's like almost $200 or $190 for a 5-day program. But it just says, eat this food.
This is what you eat.
Right.
It comes out of a kit that they design for you. Yeah.
And it can be, when you go into relative deprivation, your body then goes into a kind of a
repair.
Detox and repair mode.
Yeah.
And then when you eat again, your body's more efficient.
Mm.
And so a lot of good things happen on the refeeding phase.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of rebooting your immune system. I mean, it's similar to your computer slow. You just, hit, refresh or reboot.
Yeah.
And, you got a clean slate.
Yeah. Wow. So, Steve, thank you very much for your very thoughtful email.
Well, time flies when you're having fun, and we're a little bit over time for part one. So let's forecast, preview a little bit of what we're going to address in part two.
Where can I find information on diet, vitamins, and supplements beneficial to a newborn?
Oh, wow. Okay. Good question. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Layla Mutin. She's our nutritionist in residence, and we're bringing you our weekly Q&A with Layla. Questions can come to radioprogram@aol.com. We'll be right back.